welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We're always interested in your thoughts. Drop us a note to indianaweekend@gmail.com with your suggestions and comments. Let us know what's going on where you are. Well, it's finally here. After a year of torch relays, community celebrations, and books, the state's official 200th birthday is December 11th. For Statehood Day, there will be a free family event on Sunday morning at the Indiana State Fairgrounds. The Indiana Historical Society in Indianapolis is also hosting several events, with information available at indianahistory.org. Ray Boomhauer is editor of the Indiana Historical Society's magazine, Traces of Indiana and Midwestern History. He's also the author of more than a dozen books about Indiana, including Hoosier biographies of astronaut Gus Grissom, Lew Wallace, and Ernie Pyle. We talked with Ray as part of our Indiana Bicentennial coverage. He says the birthday can help us think about where the state's been and maybe where we're headed.
Well, whenever you have one of these celebrations that mark an auspicious time in a state's history, a community's history, people always look to the past and think about, you know, where have we been, where are we going for the future? And I think the Bicentennial offers that opportunity, as the Centennial did in 1916. And I always like to look back at that celebration because it did some important things for the state. We had our state park system started with McCormick's Creek and Turkey Run, a legacy that's still around today and that people can go to and enjoy. So one of the things I would encourage people to do is go out and visit Indiana State Parks and take a look at what the people did 100 years ago that's still around today and still important for today's generation. And I think that's true of everything as far as, you know, historic sites in the state. There are a lot of places around Indiana and in every region of the state that are important to a community's past that are sometimes neglected by the people who actually live there. They take it for granted too often. So there are places like the Ernie Pyle home in Dana, Indiana. That's hard to get to, but it's an important part of our state's history, and he's an important figure in our state. So these are places that people should kind of make pilgrimages to and rediscover Indiana's past. There are communities like Madison and New Albany who were important, they were large, they were the big cities in Indiana's early history. And those are places you can walk the streets and still get a sense of what life might have been like for our Hoosier ancestors. So those are places that we really need to get back to and rediscover, I think, in 2016.
What about 1816 and what the state was like might surprise people of today?
Probably the fact that the state was kind of settled from the bottom up, because of course the Ohio River was a major route for transportation, and that's how people usually got to the state, by the river or through tough journeys over land, and how important that southern part of the state was to Indiana's early history. Cordon, New Albany, Madison, Vincennes, of course, and also the history that went on there, you know, that go to William Henry Harrison's Grouseland home in Vincennes, where a major meeting and the conflicts that went on between the early settlers and the Native American tribes that were still in the state, battling for their very livelihoods. And you can get a sense of that kind of tension and the altercations between the settlers and the Native Americans by visiting a place like Grouseland.
And there was a major meeting once between William Henry Harrison and Tecumseh. Can you tell us about that?
Well, there was this meeting between Harrison and Tecumseh at Grouseland, and you had tensions on both sides. It looked like at one point where there was going to be an altercation, a violent outburst by some of the Native Americans who accompanied Tecumseh. And tensions finally were calmed down, and the conversations went on. But it's a fascinating look at the two sides of the conflict at that time, the two sides of the issue between the Native Americans with Tecumseh and Harrison, who was promoting the settlement of the state early on in its history.
200 years ago, a journey, say, from southern Indiana to northern Indiana was like an expedition, right? You had the Buffalo Trace, but you didn't have roads or highways going north and south, right?
That's right. There weren't that. The transportation system was not well developed. Of course, in the 1830s, Indiana tried to improve its system with the Mammoth Internal Improvement Act, with a combination of canals and roads and railroads. Unfortunately, that effort failed. It was a financial disaster for the state. And I think somehow that problem, that disaster that we had with the Internal Improvements Act, kind of almost, you know, still is around in our consciousness as Hoosiers today, because, you know, one of the things that's important to the state is that it doesn't go into debt. You know, that's part of our government policy. And so that the echoes of that, still are around today in how we govern the state. So, and it's nearly, you look back all that way 200 years ago, but just if you look back before the development of the interstate highway system in the 1950s, you know, it was tough to get around 50, 60 years ago. And so a lot of those roadside drive-ins and tourist cabins that were once part of our landscape are no longer there. So things disappear fast.
Every state has a feeling of pride by the people who live there. What can we say about the Indiana character?
That's something that's kind of puzzled me, and especially with the bicentennial, I've thought about that. What is it about Indiana that's different from other states in the Midwest, the old Northwest states like Ohio, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin? And one of the things a lot of people turn to in the state is the nickname Hoosiers. It's something that sets us apart from other parts of the Midwest, but I think we pay too much attention perhaps to that word and trying to find out, you know, where did it come from? How did it get here? Instead of thinking more about what does it really mean to be a Hoosier? What's the Hoosier character? And it's something that I think people should think more about and give more attention to as the bicentennial comes to an end here. You know, there's that Hoosier myth of people from Indiana being outgoing, friendly, conservatives, you know, always with thoughts about not going too far ahead of the curve, of taking, the middle path, so to speak.
Ray Boomhauer of the Indiana Historical Society. In this, our state's 200th birthday year, writers and historians have been reflecting on what it means to be a Hoosier, what the Indiana experience so far could mean for the future.
Indiana Weekend, interesting people and places from across our region. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line. Let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com. Now here's John Strauss.
Time now for our occasional series, Hoosier Voices, real stories from the people around us. In a state built largely on manufacturing, built on the idea of making things, building things, fixing things, we're at a loss these days in so many places without enough of those things to do. So many people are asking, where have all the good jobs gone? We ran into Tony Phipps, head of a crew from Fort Wayne that was installing traffic signals in downtown Muncie. He says there are good jobs available for people who know where to look. It's not the first time we've heard this. Tony is a union electrician, age 58, married with 3 grown children. Here is his story.
My childhood was rough. I had to do what I could to make ends meet. As I became a young adult, I started out the most physical labor jobs that you can possibly imagine with the shortest amount of money you can possibly survive on. And as I got older and stronger and smarter, I got to the point where it was smarter for me to join a union. I joined the union, and instantly my income skyrocketed. I was able to have a nicer car, nicer truck. I met someone. Oh, able to have money to buy, down pay a house, raise a family, have children. I encourage any boy who isn't fortunate enough or girl for that matter, too. We have women who work in this field, too, and they work just as hard as we do. And for them to get a trade, our workforce is dying. You go and look at the bridges, and right now, and you get out there and you look at the guys building the bridges, they all have gray beard stubbles, and they're all bent over and broken knuckles, and they're all old dudes. We don't have no young dude.
There's not enough young people coming into the trades, is there?
There is not enough young dudes, is what we call them. We need more muscle. I need five guys to train. Hey, I need you to walk down there and get that so I don't have to, because I'm busy right now. And after they do that a couple of thousand times, then they'll be in the same boat I'm in.
You know, what you hear sometimes is that the good jobs have gone away, the manufacturing jobs, that kind of stuff.
There's a lot of jobs out there, and all you got to do is go and get it. But there's a lot of things that people don't realize right now, and there's not particularly college kids, but you don't have to go to college to be able to get a good job. I don't know why we don't have the young people getting into these trades. We need them. The country's starving for them. Just go out on any project where you see them laying asphalt and you see them pouring sidewalks. You'll find a few young dudes, but you're going to see a lot of old guys who are, when they're gone, who's going to teach these young guys? Who's going to teach them?
Was it hard to get into the union? It used to be hard to break into the union.
It's still kind of hard to get in. They have waiting lists, and you have to pay to get in. You have to have one-time payment to get in, whether it's $1,000 or $750. But they also have them, like the union I'm in, it's only, I don't know, it's less than $25 or something to join. But then you got to become an apprentice, and then you have to purchase the books, just like going to Ball State. You have to buy your books. When you're through with those, you graduate that class, you move up to the next one. Then you got to purchase another set of books. You figure, once all said and done, and you spend $1,500 on that small of an education, you come into a field like this, and you're going to make $70,000 a year.
How long does it take to get to that level?
Once you become an apprentice, you'll have to do that for like 5 years, and then once you're out of the apprenticeship, you're making big money. You're making big money.
Big money like?
Like $100,000 a year easily. And you'll work a lot of hours. You may not work a lot of hours in the wintertime. We all go through that, but you gotta be smart enough to put some in savings.
Union electrician Tony Phipps, working on a street lighting project in downtown Muncie, part of our occasional series on Hoosier Voices. On a day when we're celebrating the state's history, an update from one person's perspective on where we are now.
80 degrees down in southern Florida. There's nowhere I'd rather be, it's true. That in Indiana holding you.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
History is about the stories of people, and you've written so much about some of our personalities. Are there people that you find yourself going back to, or you know, telling stories about, who maybe we ought to, just as we use the bicentennial as impetus to get out and see places, it's probably worth a look back at some of these important figures in the state's history?
Well, I always have a lot of different Hoosiers who have drawn my interest over the years. Ernie Pyle, for his work in World War II, covering the average GI in North Africa, Italy, and Europe. But he also was someone who had his finger on the pulse of what America was going through during the Great Depression during the 1930s, when he was a vagabond correspondent. You know, he was the first Charles Kuralt before there was a Charles Kuralt on the road, traveling around the country, reporting on interesting people and interesting historic sites in the United States. So those travel writings of Ernie Pyle are something that I would encourage people to go back and take another look at and read them, as well as his World War II columns. Traveling, I think the state for the bicentennial is great. And Crawfordsville is another community that people should go to, particularly the Lew Wallace study in Crawfordsville, because Lew Wallace is one of my favorite characters from Indiana's past. He did so much. He truly was an Indiana Renaissance man, a lawyer, a politician, a writer, a soldier, a diplomat. And I always encourage people, when they can, to pick up his autobiography, particularly the first volume, because he was able to finish it before his death. And you really get a sense of what it was like living in Indiana during its early history, and the monumental things that were going on in the state leading up to the Civil War, and how Wallace was called upon by Governor Oliver P. Morton to help raise the regiments that Abraham Lincoln called for when the war broke out, and Wallace's role in that and his early days and triumphs during the Civil War. So going to Crawfordsville, seeing the study he built with the prophets from his best-selling book, Ben-Hur, A Tale of the Christ, and reading his autobiography, I think you get a good sense of what it meant to be a Hoosier.
Lew Wallace underwent, Ben-Hur was a result of kind of a conversion experience, right?
Right. He was on a train going to the Grand Army of the Republic convention, and he happened to come across Robert Ingersoll, who was a fellow Civil War veteran like himself, and Ingersoll was a noted agnostic, and so they got into an often spirited discussion about religion and the belief in God and the hereafter. And that really, I think, spurred Wallace, who wasn't a big Christian at that time, to think more about his own faith. And that led eventually to Ben-Hur, one of the best-selling books of all time.
Some of our best-known Indiana authors shaped how we saw ourselves and understand Hoosier history today.
Yeah, in a way, I think that James Whitcomb Riley had a bigger influence on the state than people even realize today in how Hoosiers view themselves. That, we're country folk, that we enjoy the bucolic old swimming hole and going to old Aunt Mary's. But even when Riley was writing his poetry in the early 20th century, Indiana was no longer a farm state. It was an industrial giant with the natural gas boom of the 1890s, bringing more manufacturing to the state. The growth of the automobile with people like, of course, the Duesenberg, Studebaker in South Bend, Carl Fisher developing the Indianapolis Motor Speedway here in Indianapolis. And the automobile was king in Indiana for a time. But the entrepreneurial spirit seemed to vanish for a time, particularly after the end of World War I, and the automobile industry, moved away from the, kind of the back room, one car at a time, specialized development that we had in Indiana to the assembly line of Henry Ford's Detroit. So, what happened to have Indiana lose that bit of automotive industry that we had for a time? Of course, the automotive plant industry remained behind in Kokomo. The parts industry remained behind in Kokomo and Anderson and other places. But of course, in the 1980s, with the economic crash, a lot of those factories are no longer giving good jobs to high school graduates as they were in the 1950s and the 1960s. So what's going to happen next for the state? What's our next boom that might help move us into the next 100 years for our state?
For people today looking back and wanting to understand the genesis or the DNA of our state character, there is James Whitcomb Riley. We had some other distinguished Hoosier authors as well.
If you want to look at how Indiana changed and our the way that we went from maybe a farm state to the industrial might that we had in the early 20th century, there's no better novel to read than Booth Tarkington's Magnificent Ambersons, because that talks about, the growth of the automobile and the way that Indianapolis itself changed. And that's a fictional look at how the state changed. One of my favorite books about Indiana history is a book by John Bartlow Martin called Indiana and Interpretation. And that was published originally in 1947. And it's been republished in a couple editions by Indiana University Press over the years. And although, you know, Martin was not a historian, he was a freelance writer and a former newspaper reporter, I think he captured in that one book a lot of good information about what Indiana was, maybe some of the things that might have gone wrong in the state that stopped it. He kind of had the view that Indiana kind of suffered from hardening of the arteries in the early 20th century after its golden age of literature, the development of the automobile, and the entrepreneurs that were involved in that. And he traces that very well. It's a great book to read. It's very well written. And it really takes a great look at a character who's often lost in Indiana history, Eugene Debs, Terre Haute's own, who was so important in the labor movement and the Socialist Party, you know, five-time candidate as the Socialist Party for president, even got almost a million votes while he was in prison for sedition in World War I. So, you know, really, Debs almost runs away with the book in Martin's Indiana interpretation, and it really gives some great detail about, you know, the Hoosier myth, what we were as a people, and what we might be for the future.
Ray Boomhauer, an editor with the Indiana Historical Society and author of more than a dozen Indiana books, including Hoosier biographies of astronaut Gus Grissom, Lew Wallace, and Ernie Pyle. We talked with Ray as part of our Indiana Bicentennial coverage. Along with that, a segment from our occasional series, Hoosier Voices, on the people whose thoughts capture a sense of the times. We talked with electrician Tony Phipps about jobs, opportunity, and his story growing up in Muncie. This weekend caps the year-long bicentennial celebration, which has its own Facebook page, of course. For the December 11 Statehood Day, there will be a free family event that morning at the Indiana State Fairgrounds. Other events going on at the Indiana Historical Society in Indianapolis, with information available at indianahistory.org. That's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Sean Ashcraft, and all the folks in the front office, including your friends Matt Bloom, Connie Clary, Lori Georgie, Emily Kowalski, Andrea Lutz, John Morgan, Angie Rapp, and Debbie Webb. Glad you could join us this time. Hope you'll stay in touch. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you would like more information or have a suggestion. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Sean Ashcraft. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from IPR's listeners. We hope you'll join your friends who are IPR members. You can go to indianapublicradio.org or give us a call at 1-800-646-1812. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.